Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look into the incredible shrinking party, the Republicans, who have devolved into an angry white Southern fundamentalist party dominated by the worldview of James Dobson, who has no religious credentials but nevertheless leads the religious right. We'll be talking about that with Max Blumenthal, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, documentary filmmaker, columnist, media commentator, and New York Times best-selling author. Max Blumenthal is sometimes referred to as the Michael Moore of online video for his numerous widely recognized video reports that have garnered hundreds of thousands of hits on YouTube and other sites. He's also the Puffin Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute, a research fellow for Media Matters for America, and a senior contributor to The Daily Beast. Max Blumenthal's first book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, was published earlier this month and is now a New York Times bestseller. And then we'll be joined by David Nywert, who's an award-winning journalist who covers racism, extremism, culture, and politics in America. He's the author of a number of books, and including Death on the 4th of July, The Story of the Killing, A Trial, and Hate Crimes in America, and In God's Country. And his latest book is The Eliminationists: How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. And we're just waiting now to hear from Max Blumenthal whether or not... is Max joining us?
I'm here.
Oh, he is. Well, Max, here I am, twisting in the wind here, hoping for you to show. So you're up in Alaska?
I am. It's my one-year anniversary. I came up a year ago to go to Sarah Palin's church, and I'm just doing a series of events here, and I'm on my way down to L.A., so I'll be there on Thursday at University of Riverside at 7 p.m. for a free event.
Oh, good. Now, when you were up there last time, you were exploring the role of that witch doctor, weren't you, from Kenya?
Right. In 2005, Sarah Palin was anointed at her church of 20 years, the Wasilla Assembly of God, by a pastor named Bishop Thomas Muthi, who had claimed to have cast out witches from his hometown of Kiambu, Kenya, and in doing so ending this epidemic of prostitution and crime in his town because they believe in demonic possession at her church. And he anointed her in a public ceremony against the spirit of witchcraft. And I found out that he was coming back while she was on the campaign trail to speak again to the Wasilla Assembly of God. And so they were not allowing members of the media into the church, so I had to actually go in and sort of infiltrate in order to insinuate myself into the crowd to see him speak and to film it. I had to speak in tongues, so it was quite an experience, rattling off the names of the Jackson siblings while Christian rock band played.
Well, I guess you were making as much sense as anybody else there.
So
tell me about Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. It's already become a New York Times bestseller. You've done a lot of this kind of guerrilla work. You just pointed out how you infiltrated Sarah Palin's church a year ago were forced to talk in tongues. I saw some of the YouTube stuff of you at a religious right convention and where you tried to have the Reverend Hagee explain his theology. you got kicked out of there too, right?
Well, he wasn't too happy when I asked him about passages in his book where he called the Holocaust a divinely ordained phenomenon in order to bring the Jews into Israel to fulfill biblical prophecy, and that Hitler was actually a biblical figure. So he had a team of off-duty cops remove me. But, I've been covering this movement, the Christian right, which I think took over the Republican Party and controls it for 6 years since the start of my journalistic career. And this book is really just an effort to package all my experiences and my research and my reporting together with kind of an analysis on not just who the people are that comprise this movement or what they do, because I think that's well known, but what drives them and what's behind all the histrionics and the resentment. What's behind the witch hunting? What's behind the all the bizarre displays we've been seeing with the teabaggers, even, because they are, in so many ways, populated by members of the religious right.
Well, one of the things, you know, since I normally on this show, often on this program, we try to explore what's happening abroad, and particularly with these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Iran features quite often in particularly lately with that the coup by the Revolutionary Guards and led by Ahmadinejad. And one of the odd things about you know the Republican Party having been captured by the religious right are the similarities that these dispensationalist, you know, end of timers have with the Ahmadinejad and his belief system. You know, he's also messianic, believes in the second coming, the hidden imam's going to return. He talks in tongues and sends messages down the wells to the hidden imam. It's extraordinary that this phenomenon, I mean, you know, the neocons throw around words like Islamo-fascists, but nobody talks about Christo-fascists.
Well, you know, I don't want to get too much into comparisons because I'm not an expert on Shia Islam, but the great social philosopher Eric Hoffer said that, you know, extremists attract each other. They're magnetized to each other from, you know, opposite ends, and that they have more in common than they have, you know, that there's more similarities than contrasts between extremists. And if you look at the antecedents of the religious right, the people who inspired them, if you look at, you know, let's talk about the sugar daddy of the religious right, someone who's a local figure in L.A., Howard F. Amundsen Jr. This is, you know, someone who funds the intelligent design movement. He put up $1.5 million for Prop 8. And he provided 50% of the funding for Prop 22, the previous anti-gay ballot initiative in California. In 1985, Howard F. Amundsen Jr. declared, "My goal," he told the, I think, the Orange County Register, "my goal is the total integration of biblical law into our everyday lives." He wanted a theocracy in America. Now, when Amundsen was 18, he inherited $300 million from his father, who had founded Washington Mutual, who everyone down there knows because he's such a great philanthropist. And Amundsen's father had died. His mother died soon after. He was left alone in a mansion, and he went crazy. He went into a mental institution for 2 years, and when he came out, he met R.J. Rushdoony, this theologian who had written all these books about how America could be transformed into a theocracy in which the criminal justice system would be replaced by Leviticus case law, and evildoers ranging from homosexuals to disobedient children to blasphemers to witches would all be killed. I guess you could call it the Christian right's trigger option. You know, Rushdoony's son-in-law, Gary North, who is a former economics advisor to Ron Paul, believed that the evildoers should be stoned to death because he's an economist and stones are cheaper. So you see this strain in the Christian right of extreme you know, these extreme theocratic tendencies. And as you mentioned, they also, many of them, are lusting for the end of the world. You know, when I went to Hagee's conference, and you can see this in my video, Rapture Ready, I just went around asking people, "Are you looking forward to Armageddon?" And they said, "Oh, yeah, I'm looking forward to Armageddon and the cleansing of the earth." You know, this almost Hitlerian language of purification of the earth through mass violence. So you do see that, and when I hear them talk about Ahmadinejad and his, you know, his end times prophecy of the 12th Mahdi, I think it sounds just like a projection.
Right. Well, but there's also, there's a sort of element of criminal insanity in this, that American citizens would want their neighbors to end in lives to end in burning flesh, so that their lives could begin. I mean, chutzpah and hubris don't begin to describe that condition.
Well, you know, there is a connection, I think, between, you know, the fear of death and conservatism, and I talk about that in my book, you know, citing the social philosopher Ernest Becker. I think it really applies really well to the end times mentality. You know, Becker, in his book, The Denial of Death, says that, you know, death is really the source of everyone's greatest anxieties. And it's also the source of so much persistent conservatism in American society. And a group of researchers from Harvard University who were influenced by Becker, who was really popular in the 60s and early 70s, set out to prove his theories, to prove that this was true, that there was a connection between the fear of death and conservatism. So in one study, they took a group of judges, and one of control group they did nothing to, but the test group, they gave them surveys about what their death would be like, what they thought their death would be like. Then they asked the entire group to set bail for a prostitute who was a runaway threat, who was a threat to flee. And the group that didn't receive the surveys about their death set her bail at $80, but the group that did, who were reminded of their own death, set her bail at $430, you know, proving that they would become more draconian if they were thinking about death while making this decision. And they continued doing these studies, you know, showing more and more direct connections between the fear of death and conservatism. And I think that showed why this country, the United States, had such a conservative turn after 9/11. People were receiving constant mortality reminders from the Bush administration. Max Cleland's face, you know, the Vietnam War hero's face, was morphed into Bin Laden's face in a Senate race in Georgia, and the Republicans were able to sweep into control of Congress. But I mean, if you look at the end timers, the people who are lusting for Armageddon, this is an effort for them to transcend, you know, not only the anxiety and trauma of their everyday lives, but to transcend their impending death with Christ coming back and ushering in a 1,000-year reign, while you and I are going to burn in an everlasting lake of fire.
Again, I'm talking with Max Blumenthal, the author of a new book, a New York Times bestseller, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. And we're looking into the incredible shrinking party, the Republicans, who have devolved into an angry white Southern fundamentalist party, dominated by the worldview of James Dobson, who has no religious credentials, but nevertheless appears to lead the religious right. You mentioned earlier about the fear of death. It seems to me that much of the opposition that you see to President Obama has manifested itself, and obviously a lot of the people showed up a weekend ago in Washington were angry white Southerners, hypertensive, overweight, and carrying some really incendiary and disgusting signs. But it seems to me that they are dying a metaphoric death, you know, that they're reacting against their own irrelevance and endangerment, that they're entering a world where it just doesn't mean that much to be white. Being white is not a ticket to dominate others. It doesn't. They're terrified of. They can't hate Obama because he's black, which is the real subtext. But right-wing radio is giving them, and Fox News is giving them permission to hate him for all kinds of made-up reasons, like he's not. He's a stealth Muslim. He wasn't born in this country, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the Republican Party's become the party of birthers, deathers, and Civil War reenactors. And, you know, we can get to Dobson in a minute, but right now the de facto spokesman of the Republican Party is Congressman Joseph Wilson, just because he had this rebel yell in Congress. And he was the hero of the, you know, the Tea Party rally on 9/12 on the National Mall, which I attended. You know, I shot a video there. And I met so many people. I met people from Mississippi wearing T-shirts identifying themselves as freedom riders, you know, a deliberate attempt to mock the civil rights movement. These were all mostly Southern white people waving Confederate flags. The only African-American I saw there was so severely handicapped he couldn't speak or see. And I wonder what he would have said about it. But he was being pushed by a white family holding a sign of Obama as Hitler. You know, and if you look at the polls, you look at the approval rating of congressional Republicans, you'll see how narrow the Republican Party's become. In the Northeast, in the northeastern United States, congressional Republican approval rating is 7%. In the West and the Midwest, it's 20%, which isn't much better. And in the Deep South, it's 60%. You know, it's really truly the party of Joseph Wilson and his, you know, who is his chief advisor? Who's behind this guy who made this rebel yell? It's Richard Quinn, neo-Confederate who wrote in a white supremacist magazine called Southern Partisan in 1983 that the person who's done the most damage to African Americans is Martin Luther King, and therefore there should never be a federal holiday for him. I mean, these are the people guiding the party, and you see them attacking Obama in this, with this violent rhetoric. it's more intense. I mean, they did this under Clinton, and they saw Clinton as sort of a race traitor. And when Newt Gingrich shut down Congress, when he shut down the federal government in 1995, leading up to the impeachment of the president, a right-wing anti-government terrorist blew up the Oklahoma City federal building, killing hundreds of Americans. Abortion clinics were attacked. Abortion doctors were assassinated. We saw mass domestic terrorism. Eric Rudolph was hidden. People were assisting Eric Rudolph, an anti-abortion terrorist in Appalachia, putting up signs saying, "Run, Eric, run." This was the 90s, and now it's even more intense because we have a 24-hour news cycle. Glenn Beck, the top-rated host on Fox News, is warning of Obama building concentration camps for Americans. So you have to be concerned about the intensification of this campaign that began in the 90s with the anti-government militia movement, went dormant during the Bush era, and it has now sort of reemerged mm-hmm. with more intensity than before.
And it may well be that this census worker who was murdered in Kentucky, stripped naked and hanged, bound and hanged in a cemetery with written in felt-tip pen across his chest, apparently, fed. It may well be that that is perpetrated by these militia groups or something akin to them, incited by the Glenn Becks of the world. But, you know, given that these people aren't just rhetorically dangerous, they're armed and dangerous, my fear is that somebody's going to take a shot at the president. And at that point, who do you blame? Do you blame Beck, Limbaugh and those guys, or do you blame Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes, the corporatists who are benefiting from this kind of Goebbels-like incitement?
Well, I mean, everyone has to be held responsible for the consequences of this violent rhetoric we're seeing. But I talk in my book about how this started, actually, after Roe v. Wade. The Christian right and the radical right, which was sort of incipient at the time, was not really interested in abortion. And a theologian named Francis Schaeffer convinced them to attack abortion, to go after abortion clinics, to use force in the defensive posture. He convinced Jerry Falwell and the people behind Operation Rescue, who are who were responsible. An Operation Rescue member killed Dr. George Tiller in Kansas, to go after abortion, not because abortion is so bad, but because it's a symbol of secular government. It's a symbol of the evil underbelly of America's government. And so what I think the radical right would do if there was going to be political violence is not to go directly after Obama, but to go after symbols of his administration. So we saw in Pittsburgh recently, I mean, this has already happened, whether or not this Fed worker was killed as a result of, Michelle Bachmann, the congressman from Minnesota, going on air and warning that the census is collecting information so they can round up Americans and put them in concentration camps. This sort of thing has already happened in Pittsburgh. A 20-year-old neo-Nazi named Richard Poplawski gunned down three Pittsburgh police officers, and he had been posting YouTube clips of Glenn Beck warning about the FEMA camps, the concentration camps for Americans, on his page on stormfront.org, which is this internet hub for neo-Nazis. So after Poplawski killed these cops with a high-powered assault rifle, then killed himself, his friend was interviewed by local police, and he said, "My friend Richard hated the federal government, and he hated Obama, and he killed these cops because he saw them as agents of the Obama revolution." That's the rhetoric I was hearing from people on 9/12 at the National Mall. And I think, there needs to be discussed what you mentioned, Ian, that someone could take a shot at Obama. I think what was more likely to happen is they'll take a shot at abortion clinics. They'll take a shot at George Tiller. They'll take a shot at anyone who seems to represent the federal government or the bureaucracy that the radical right is constantly attacking on Fox News.
But what is happening to this country? It's losing its mind because Americans are turning against Americans. Is it because of Manichaeism that there's no enemy anymore? That the communists went away, and now they're making up enemies, black helicopters, all this kind of stuff. I mean, what What explains that that derangement syndrome, and why would people want to go off into the hills and train with assault weapons to kill who? The only people at the end of the day they're planning on killing are Americans, just like that McVeigh did in Oklahoma. I mean,
right. Well, I like to say they love America, but they just don't like it very much. And this story, this country is really the story of competing traditions. I mean, they've always been there. We had the Civil War, and the neo-Confederates believe the Civil War is still continuing. But when you look behind the histrionics and behind the resentment, you see a lot of personal pain, a lot of trauma. And I think that's one of the central ideas in my book, is that behind the rights politics of resentment is a culture of personal crisis. That's what I've found in covering it. It's why I made James Dobson a central figure in my book. You know, he's the most powerful figure in the Christian right. He was directly responsible for reelecting George W. Bush, heavily influenced by the person I mentioned before, Francis Schaeffer, who sort of is the godfather of the anti-abortion movement. But he's not a religious figure. He's a psychologist, a child psychologist. And in his organization, Focus on the Family, in Colorado Springs, James Dobson operates a correspondence department, which is so large it has its own zip code. And they handle just so much mail and so many phone calls from middle Americans seeking help for mundane problems, like their child's bedwetting problem, marital strife, pornography addiction, things people are facing every day out there. But they get entered into a data bank after they put in their call and receive some Dobson-approved self-help advice. And then they're bombarded with political mailings. They're told that the homosexual agenda and abortion and liberalism are really responsible for their problems, and they're slowly transformed into radical Republican shock troops. So I think, Ian, that there's a lot of exploitation going on, and people are being told that their problems exist outside of themselves, and that by externalizing their problems and projecting their conflicted inner selves into the political arena, by purifying the land of sin, they can purify their own souls. And that's why I think we're seeing so much of that. It's why I think Obama's health care plan is such a threat to the radical right, because they've been able to exploit personal crises for so long. If the government were able to insert itself into people's lives and resolve some of the crises that stem from health care or health care costs, that would be a major threat to this industry that they've created around exploiting people.
Mm. Well, there's no question that in the Palin McCain campaign, their poster boy, Joe the Plumber, his life was a train wreck. I mean, there's a lot of pain out there of people that are one paycheck away from oblivion. But I find it extraordinary, Max Blumenthal, that in this environment, that the populist movement that seems to be coming out, and albeit stimulated through AstroTurf techniques, nevertheless, my question is, where is the left-wing populist movement? Because they have actually the narrative on their side, but the other side, the right, have appropriated the narrative of Wall Street bankers bailing out GM, the big pharma negotiating with the Obama White House. They're putting out all of this popular stuff. Their solutions actually are the opposite of, because they essentially support the Republican Party who brought all these problems in the first place. So does that puzzle you? I mean, why it is that they've been able to steal a march on the Democrats and the White House?
It doesn't totally puzzle me. I mean, and what you're talking about with the right is actually pseudo-populism. I mean, what you saw in the National Mall with all these teabaggers who thought they were fighting for freedom were actually being shepherded there by a group called Freedom Works, led by the Republican House Majority Leader Dick Armey. He's a corporate lobbyist. Freedom Works is a front group for the healthcare industry and for corporations. Armey refuses to disclose his corporate donors, and he himself has actually been on government-provided healthcare for most of his life, first as a professor at the University of North Texas, and then as a congressman. And he's just exploiting a bunch of suggestible rubes who I met, many of whom didn't have health care. I would meet people who told me they didn't have health care and they were content to rally against having it. I guess because they enjoyed participating in this glorious cause so much, to destroy Obama. This movement has no ideas. It has almost no policy except to excoriate on Obama and portray him as Hitler. On the other side, on the left, the Obama campaign in 2008 brought in, you know, just one of the most incredible, one of the most powerful movements of progressivism that I've ever seen. And I think he's wasted it by moving to the center and then by trying to pass this, you know, landmark legislation through the Senate Finance Committee, allowing Max Baucus to take charge of it, who is basically a tool for the healthcare industry. And Baucus, you know, is the Democrat who's in charge of creating Obama's healthcare plan in the Finance Committee. But on the Republican side, you have Charles Grassley, who's the ranking member, and this guy believes in death panels. So I think Barack Obama needs to, first of all, reignite his campaign, send all those young people who supported him and saw him as something just short of the Messiah back into the streets to rally for health care reform and to lobby Congress the way the right is doing. And he needs to read my book and understand the nature of the opposition, that for them, anything short of total victory is a total defeat. For them, compromise and bipartisanship eliminates the euphoria that they feel from attacking him and the sense of security they feel from joining together in this glorious cause against health care. So it's much more emotional and psychological for the right than Obama will recognize. And I've heard they're having these meetings in the White House where they're trying to figure out how to respond to all the attacks about death panels, about the plan funding undocumented immigrants, and they are totally befuddled and confused and don't know what to do.
But why can't they recapture populism by explaining the very angst, what caused the angst that is confusing people and allowing these operators, professional Republican operators like Dick Armey, to confuse and steal these people for corporate interests? I mean, is it because Obama doesn't really want to talk about what really happened on Wall Street, how Main Street got hosed, and how by bailing out these reckless oligarchs, we've missed an opportunity to bring back democracy to America, and instead we're worse than the status quo ante, where these crooks who stole billions and impoverished the lives of millions are actually better off, richer, more powerful, and are even too bigger to fail?
I mean, he's demonstrated a fear of attacking the insurance industry, and it has a lot to do with who's behind him. Rahm Emanuel's taken millions from the insurance industry when he was in Congress, and he used this money to fund the election of all the Blue Dog Democrats. It was Rahm who was responsible for those 35 Blue Dogs coming in, and they're being targeted by the Republicans in 2010, and Rahm is completely beholden to them. And so I think it prevents Obama from using truly populist rhetoric. And behind Rahm's mini-me, his assistant chief of staff is Jim Messina. He is the former chief of staff to Max Baucus, who takes more health care industry money than any other Democrat, and who sent five of his former staffers into the health care industry. So there's just a clear connection between the Obama and administration and the health care industry, and that has tempered his rhetoric and his ability to explain who's behind all of this and who's really, you know, hurting Main Street America.
Well, Max, in the last few minutes we've got, let's turn back to your book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. You're coming in next week, I believe, in person. But in the meantime, is there anything you can say that will inspire people? Since the other side is inciting all kinds of insanity, let's try and be inspirational here for a moment.
Well, I'm probably the last guy to ask for inspiration. I mean, my book is really a critique of a movement that took over the Republican Party and shattered it. And so if there's any hope you can take away from that, it's that the movement, the Republican Party, that the party is shattered, and that that there are there is a huge opportunity here to pass progressive legislation across the board, from health care reform to immigration reform to criminal justice reform. And it's not just up to Obama to solve the problem. I really think he needs to be pushed by progressive grassroots elements. And beyond that, I think there's a progressive moment in the media where we're seeing independent voices like you emerge, that were out there in the wilderness warning about the Bush administration, when the mainstream press had felt a collective thrill going up its leg when, you know, Bush went to Iraq. And my book was vaulted onto the bestseller list without me having almost any media, you know, putting me among some of the worst people in American letters, Bill O'Reilly and Michelle Malkin, who have their right-wing megaphone to plug their books every night. And I think that shows the power of progressive media and the power of independent voices like you. You know, your show was the first show I was ever on in my journalistic career. And it's you and so many other hosts across the country who've put my book where it is on the bestseller list, and who are, you know, creating this progressive moment. So it's really up to the grassroots and, you know, people to seize the moment.
And put a wind at Obama's back. I mean, FDR, exactly. when he was sort of faltering under right wing attacks, when he was trying to put through the New Deal, a lot of the New Deal activists came to him and said, you know, we want you to do more. And FDR said to them, make me do it.
A. Philip Randolph, who was the head of the Porters Union, which was the de facto leader of the civil rights movement at the time, went to meet with FDR, and he said, can we please pass some civil rights legislation? And he said, you know, FDR said, I want to do that, and you know my wife wants to do that for sure, but I need to see you in the streets to give me cover. I need you to pressure me to do that. And that's what A. Philip Randolph did.
And that's the value of your book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. This is ammunition to motivate people to understand what they're up against and what they have to do.
Precisely, and I think you know, beyond showing the nature of the threat, I think I've been reading it myself. It's a pretty good book. It's pretty entertaining.
Let me introduce my producer, Lewis Vandenberg, and the program director here at KBFK, Alan Minsky.
Hey, Max, how are you doing?
Good. How are you, Lewis?
I'm fine, and I actually, you know, I'm so proud of you. I mean, I remember when we first put you on the program. And I thought, I didn't know that you were the son of your father, Sidney Blumenthal, I think your dad's great, but I just thought, this guy's brilliant. This is a great article. And it was the Day of the Dead article. But you've come up with a lot of stuff in this book that I was not aware of. And as you go through it, it's... you know, there's a quote from Hedrick Hertzberg that I think gets it perfectly. He says in The New Yorker, a riveting account of a religio-political subculture that's even weirder than you thought it was. Now, I thought it was weird.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the weirdness factor. I mean, it was weirder than I thought when I started writing it. I started uncovering all these bizarre connections between, for example, Ted Bundy and James Dobson,
right.
How a serial killer vaulted Dobson onto the national stage. And for me, writing it, I mean, it was an education and was fascinating. And I think it's an enduring book because it's not just about what's happening now. It's about how we got here.
And it's 60 pages of footnotes.
And it's
60 pages of footnotes.
And it's funny.
Yeah.
It's really entertaining, too.
Well, you know, if I was there, I'd kiss you guys.
Okay, we're going to say goodbye to Max, and we'll see you on Thursday and next week. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot,
Ian,
Mac.
Lewis, and Alan.
And say hi to Shannon Moore and Phil Munger for me.
I will, for sure.
All right.
And I'm now speaking with David Neiwirth, who's an award-winning journalist who covers racism, extremism, culture, and politics in America. He's the author of a number of books, including Strawberry Days, How Internment Destroyed the Japanese-American Community, Death on the 4th of July, A Story of a Killing, a Trial, and Hate Crime in America, and In God's Country, the Patriot Movement and the Pacific Northwest, and his new book, The Eliminationists, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. And thank you so much for joining us, David.
Good to be with you, Ian. How are you today?
Very well. We're We just got through with Max Blumenthal has written Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, that examines this phenomenon, how the grand old party has become the incredible shrinking party, which has, you know, devolved into an angry white Southern fundamentalist party, dominated by the worldview of James Dobson, who is actually not even has any, no religious credentials, but nevertheless seems to be an important intellectual force behind the new Republican Party. But you're bringing in another filling in another part of the story here, and that is how the media has played a role in inciting the radical right through hate radio and Fox News with demagogues such as Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck. Just let's begin with the title, The Eliminationists. I take it what you're saying here is that contrary to the tradition of American democracy and discourse, the purpose of this new ideology of radical conservatism is to close down debate. And to pursue the outright elimination of the opposing viewpoint. And that certainly seems to be the MO of people like David Horowitz and others who run around campuses basically saying that, you know, there's only one narrative about Israel, and any professor who diverges from that has to be immediately fired or harassed out of office. So give us a sense of what's happening here in terms of shutting down debate and by basically saying there's only one side of the story. I mean, it's very fascistic, really, in its essence.
Right, and I discuss fascism and what it really means, not the Jonah Goldberg version of fascism, but the very real version of it. You know, I started writing this book. What this book came out of is, you know, the work that I've done over the years reporting on the radical right. And for me, you know, going back to the 80s and the late 70s, there was always a huge difference between the extremist right and mainstream conservatives. And, there was a gap between them, and you could always distinguish between the two sort of political blocks. And it's been my observation that in the past 10 years particularly, that distance has vanished, and the differences are beginning to fade into obscurity. And you could particularly see this, for instance, at the Tea Parties that are going on right now, which are just rampant with old right-wing extremist rhetoric straight out of the militia movement of the 1990s. And the similar sort of wingnuttery and belief systems where you believe things that are palpably untrue, like the birther conspiracy theory and the various, you know, the death panels and various other conspiracy theories that they've managed to come up with. And a lot of this has to do with, I mean, the extremist right's solutions have always been fundamentally eliminationist, which is that they don't believe in actually, as you say, suggest, having discourse with other people, but rather it's simply their solution for everything is to eliminate the toxic elements of society. And so a lot of their rhetoric is devoted towards demonizing and dehumanizing their opponents and turning them, making them to be basically objects fit only for elimination. From our body politic. And, you know, this is profoundly toxic, as you suggest. I call it the death of discourse. And it's really toxic, especially to a democratic society. And we need to start waking up to its ongoing existence. Max's book is very good.
I was going to say, David, that sort of reminds me of what McCarthy did, though, in the 50s, by simply labeling political opponents communists, they were able to sort of, you know, basically stifle debate and terrorize people into submission. And of course, ever since then, the Democratic Party's been looking over its shoulder, trying to prove that it's just as anti-communist as the Republicans are. It seems to me that we're reliving that to some extent. I mean, I guess they're not calling anybody communist now, but they're soft on terrorists, and they want to bring about socialized medicine.
Oh, they are calling people communists. I mean, that's actually, there's a pretty good video out available now called The Return of McCarthyism. We have it up at our site at crooksandliars.com. And, yeah, I mean, that's what Glenn Beck has been doing. He's been accusing Van Jones and you know, not just Van Jones, but all of these Obama czars, these appointees, of being secretly radical communists who want to remake America into at least a socialist state, if not a communist one. I mean, that's been the upshot of Glenn Beck's thesis for the past probably month and a half or two.
Has Glenn Beck not noticed what happened to the communists in the Soviet Union and China? I mean,
he's inspired by a guy named W. Cleon Skousen, who was an old, you know, he wrote The Naked Communist. He was an old John Bircher back in the 60s. And in fact, the Birchers kind of got leery of him because he got so far out there on his right wing limb.
Boy, that's saying something.
Yeah. Beck promotes Skousen's books on air on Fox News.
What's the thesis then? Because, you know, the communists, of course, their legacy in history will be that they all but destroyed socialism. You know, and the idea that that somehow this incredible bunch of incompetents who drove the Soviet Union into the ground and who now have become completely irrelevant in China, except that they've become a kind of mafia. The ruling clique used the party as a kind of patina for their own kind of power and greed. I mean, what's the definition? What's Beck's definition of a communist, for God's sake?
His definition of a communist basically is somebody who wants to tax other people.
I see.
That's basically what it comes down to. They have this, you know, sort of. I mean, you have to understand, especially for his audience, and particularly people out there in rural America, this is sort of their basic conception of communism / socialism. And now, of course, they're throwing fascism in there, too. They're calling Obama a fascist as well, which is why we're seeing the Hitler mustaches and things like that thrown up. And it's all very confused. Some of this happens to have come out of Jonah Goldberg's execrable book, Liberal Fascism, which Beck is a big fan of. But essentially, fundamentally, what it is an attack on progressivism. And, you know, this is all, it's really a broad-based attack that goes back to trying to essentially overturn the legacy of the New Deal.
But there's no, this is not an intellectual attack. This is just a sort of name-calling, throwing incendiary labels, hoping
That's
they'll stick. I mean, does Goldberg offer anything more than just this heated rhetoric?
Oh, Goldberg. Well, Goldberg is a different case. He offers a sort of convoluted pseudo-intellectual argument that argues that basically fascism was properly, as he writes it, was properly known as a left-wing phenomenon, not a right-wing phenomenon. And he constructs a very, shall we say, strained version of history in order to support this thesis. But, you know, his book was a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list, and it's actually become sort of embedded conventional wisdom among right-wingers. I mean, after the Holocaust shooting, I did a lot of radio in support of this book because I do predict in the book that there's going to be an outbreak of right-wing domestic terrorism, sort of like what James von Brunn did. And I was surprised by, you know, when we do take the questions from the callers, people who would call in and say if the subject of fascism would come up, they would argue that it's actually liberals who are the real fascists. And so it's actually become pretty widespread on the right, and it's become sort of conventional wisdom that fascism was actually liberalism.
But that's it. But I mean, I guess, you know, no point in arguing with people who aren't interested in data and facts. I guess it's kind of a fool's errand. But just for the record, it's pretty clear that fascism involves corporatism and the use of corporate power to gin up these stormtroopers generate their political ends. I mean, Hitler called himself a national socialist only to con the working class into supporting him. Meanwhile, of course, he was killing off the union leaders and the oligarchs and the the big industrialists were perfectly happy to see the unions broken.
That's right. Although fascism in its early phases wasn't particularly corporatist. When it was black shirts and squadristi out there in the countryside, they were doing that, the thuggery and attacking union leaders and killing people in the countryside, socialists in the countryside, mostly on behalf of landowners, wealthy landowners, and basically the sort of status quo authorities is who the black shirts were out there working in support of. And that makes them, marks them pretty clearly, I think, a right-wing phenomenon. And the same could be true, was true of the brown shirts in the early days. It wasn't until they actually started obtaining power and gaining traction as a real political entity that they started becoming corporatist. And then they very clearly did everything they could to sort of attract corporate backing. And the corporations were more than happy to hire them, basically, to be their thugs to... You know, they saw them. They saw the squadristi and the brown shirts as sort of a bulwark against communists, mm-hmm. socialists, and that was why they sure. formed that alliance with them.
And we have a kind of contemporary version of that, obviously not quite as inflammatory, but in the sense that corporatists through these astroturf operations run by Dick Armey and funded by the Koch family. The 19th richest family in the world. They're behind these 9/12 movements, and Glenn Beck has ginned up and got people to show up in Washington to defeat health care. As Max Blumenthal, who went to the rally, said, you know, he talked to people who don't have health care, who are actively campaigning against health care. I mean, it's completely surreal. You know, this is welcome to Joe the Plumber world. But... Let's get into your book, David. You know, the Eliminationists, how hate talk radicalized the American right. Let's just sort of walk us through how the media has been used to incite and to galvanize this group.
Well, what I saw beginning in the 1990s was a lot of trafficking in ideas that originated on the extremist right by mainstream conservatives. This is particularly true, I thought, during the whole Clinton impeachment brouhaha, when I saw a lot of stuff come bubbling up into sort of mainstream right-wing talking points that I used to hear being bandied about back in, you know, 1994, 95 among militia leaders. And it was very interesting to me to watch those ideas migrate. And the way that it happens is that there are people who are sort of these transitional figures, I call them transmitters, who pick up ideas from the far right and sort of repackage them for mainstream consumption, but take the core essential idea and present it to mainstream, you know, for mainstream consumption. And, you know, the classic one, classic example of this, of course, is Rush Limbaugh, who picks up all kinds of stuff from the far right all the time. But in the past decade, we've had plenty of examples from people like Lou Dobbs, who takes information straight from white supremacist websites and runs them out on CNN as graphics for people that tell people that, you know, Latinos are planning to invade, are actually planning to return the southwest of America to Mexico.
Right, and they're spreading leprosy and all this insane, despicable stuff.
Right. Dobbs is a classic case of a guy who transmits extremist ideas and extremist talking points. And I might add, almost all of these ideas are completely fraudulent. They have no basis in fact, and the leprosy case is a classic example of that.
Mm-hmm. But the rebel yell from the congressman in front of Obama's State of the Union, his big speech on health care, the rebel yell from Wilson, that was about this racist, paranoid notion that the health care bill is all about giving free health care to undocumented Mexicans, you know?
Yeah, that's right. That was the root of it. And, of course, it didn't hurt that Representative Wilson was also a member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, which is one of the better known neo-Confederate outfits from down there in the South. But the New York Times writer, columnist, basically said that, you know, that she heard Joe Wilson say, add in the word boy there. I think she was not far off. So.
Mm. You mean, was that Maureen Dowd?
Yes, Maureen Dowd. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I was brain cramping there.
I see. Well, David, the eliminationists have hate talk radicalized the American right. Give our audience a sense of what they're getting in this book.
Well, for one thing, they're getting a rundown and a sort of explanation of how this sort of phenomenon occurs, how eliminationism is permeating our discourse and shutting down our discourse. And it goes through the history of eliminationist rhetoric. You know, it's actually buried very deeply in our soil. It's been very much part of our history from the very get-go in our dealings with Native Americans, and runs through our history with African Americans and Asian Americans. And certainly runs into the present day, you know, a classic form of sort of eliminationist behavior that's very much current is hate crimes, which are... that's the same basic behavior. And in all of these, one of the things I point out is that the rhetoric plays a very important role in all this, and that it essentially has a sort of permission-giving effect. And so finally, in the final chapter, I do discuss some strategies and have some thoughts about how we approach the actual solution, how we try to deal with this. Because part of the issue for us as progressives is that the people on the right who engage in this behavior, they see themselves as heroic. They see themselves as out to save America and doing the right thing and the good thing. And even the most extreme people, like especially, you know, someone like Scott Roeder, who shot Dr. Tiller, or James von Brunn, who shot up the Holocaust Museum. And so I discuss ways that we sort of break that cycle where we sort of feed into their paranoid beliefs by making them out to be enemies as well. And of course it's a tricky thing, because when somebody is basically their entire argument revolves around the idea that you are the enemy, that you are the cause of, you know, all the world's ills, and particularly all the nation's ills. It's pretty hard to have a sort of respectful dialogue with them. But we have to find ways, not necessarily to have dialogue with those who are doing the accusing, but I think we do need to start getting the attention of the people who might be listening to them. And so I run through some of the strategies for doing that.
Well, it just is mind-boggling, Dave and I were to try and figure out how it could be in the land of the free and the home of the brave, that it could be patriotic to hate your neighbor. It could be patriotic to go off into the woods with assault weapons and train to kill your fellow Americans. I mean, there's a sickness out here. You know, that we don't know what was behind the lynching of that census worker in Kentucky, but there are certain indications that, since he had Fed written on him, that it might be something to do with this Timothy McVeigh type thinking.
Sure.
I mean, to my mind, you know, how can the Becks and the Limbaughs who incite this stuff consider these people patriots? I mean, they consider themselves patriots.
Right. But the Becks and the Limbaughs will say is that, well, we had nothing to do with this. This is just a crazy person who did this. And, you know, it's sort of a standard cop-out. It's just palpably not true. You know, I mean, are they criminally liable? No. Are they civilly liable? Probably not. But are they morally and ethically culpable? I think so, because when you start pouring crazy ideas, I mean, it would be one thing if what Limbaugh and Beck and Michelle Bachmann, in this case, the representative from Minnesota who has been particularly out there on the warpath, warning people that the Census Bureau is trying to get their information so they can round them up into concentration camps. When you start spreading crazy ideas into people's heads like this, and then violent reaction results, there's got to be some culpability for that. And at the very least, it's ethical. You know, and this is where standing up as citizens is so vital. It's not necessarily important that we, you know, I mean, nobody's talking about silencing these people or shutting them down, but we do need to stand up to them.
Well, we've run out of time here with you today, David, and I thank you so much for your book, The Eliminationist, How Hate Talk Radicalized the American Right. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
It was my pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with David Nyward. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Janie Coolidge, the assistant producer, Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.